Happy Monday. Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. In case you missed it over the weekend while you were enjoying the beautiful weather, or I hope it was beautiful, the murder hornets are here in the United States. President Trump went to the Lincoln Memorial and actually complained that he'd been treated worse than Lincoln, who, in case you missed this, had to fight the Civil War and was assassinated. And that followed a weekend in which he tweeted out good wishes to a murderous dictator, Kim Jong-un, lashed out at a former president who'd issued a call for bipartisan unity, called a female journalist a dog, almost casually said, yeah, the projected death toll from the pandemic may be as high as 100,000, just raise that again, tweeted out quotes from a conspiracy theorist who had pushed that Pizzagate conspiracy, and fired another watchdog in the Department of Health and Human Services who angered him with a report last month highlighting supply shortages and testing delays at hospitals during the coronavirus pandemic. So, in other words, it was just another weekend in Trump world. So our special guest today joining us is, this is actually quite special for first time podcast guest, Carly Fiorina, founder, chairman of Carly Fiorina Enterprises and Unlocking Potential. Also the former CEO of Hewlett Packard, candidate for president of the United States, and for a brief shining moment, running mate of Ted Cruz back in 2016. Okay, I had to bring that up because I always mention this. By the way, good morning, Carly.
Good morning, Charlie. Thank you so much for having me. Great to be back with you after quite a while.
It's been quite a while. I have to bring up, I'm sorry to bring up the Cruz thing, but or anything involving 2016. But as I've told other guests on the podcast, I have a picture up on my wall here in my study of me and Ted Cruz, kind of as just a memorial of like, what the hell happened to all of us over the last 4 years. So, I wanted to touch base with you because you've written a lot about leadership and what it takes to lead during a time of crisis. And I'm really interested to get your sense of what we're seeing right now, whether we're getting the kind of leadership that we need from the executive branch, from Congress. So just give me your thoughts, or how are we doing on the pandemic and what do we need to do going forward?
Well, Charlie, let me start by saying that after the 2016 election, I really got re-engaged in leadership development work that I've done for many years. And the reason I sort of doubled down on it is because I think we have gotten really confused about what leadership is. And I actually think that's easy to do when times are good. And economically and in the stock market, you know, times have been good for quite a while. And so it's easy to get confused and think that leadership is about fame, position, title, popularity. But leadership has never been about those things. Leadership is about service, first and foremost, service to others. It's about problem solving and changing the order of things for the better. And leaders exhibit courage and character. They also exhibit humility and empathy. And so have we seen examples of leadership during this pandemic? Yes, but not from the White House. We've seen them from, say, Mike DeWine or Governor Cuomo or Governor Hogan or Governor Gavin Newsom. People who, again, set aside the politics, set aside policy differences. Leaders serve. They serve others and they solve the problems in front of them. And they are humble enough to understand they don't know it all. Empathetic enough to understand what other people are going through, and they collaborate with others whom they know they need to do the right thing in a tough time.
You probably saw the video that was released over the weekend by former President George W. Bush trying to, you know, calling on the nation to pull together and get beyond politics. It strikes me that Bush would accept your definition of leadership in a way that Donald Trump would not.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I have spoken at the Bush Library several times. And the last time I was there, at the invitation of President and Mrs. Bush, the subject was leadership. And yes, I think he would agree with that. I think the truth is, I think leaders get revealed in tough times. There's that old saying, you know, tough times build character. I don't think that's right. I think tough times reveal character. And I also think that tough times reveal leadership. And so I accept that there are people who will stand by a politician because they think they agree with their politics. But I think it's very hard, objectively speaking, to describe the decisions taken, the actions taken, the character that President Trump has displayed. I think it's very difficult, objectively speaking, to call that leadership.
So what has this crisis revealed about Donald Trump?
I think, in my opinion, it's revealed what we've always known about him, but what we tried to put aside. So I think what it reveals about him is that rather than serving others, he serves himself and his family. I think what it reveals about him is that he lacks humility and actually believes or says he believes that he knows more about everything than anyone else. I think what it reveals about him is a lack of empathy. I think what it reveals about him is he, instead of being someone who runs to a problem, which is what leaders do, they run to problems and they solve the problems that they are intended to solve because only they can solve them. He runs away from them. And so I think that's why you've seen the federal government fail to step up and take a leadership role in the provision of testing, the distribution of PPE, et cetera. I think it's why you've seen him back away from guidance and guidelines. That's running away from the problem instead of running to the problem.
So do these character things matter? I'm playing devil's advocate here because you can be an egotist, a narcissist, lack an empathy, and still be the general who wins the war or not.
Yeah, I think or not, honestly. And that's why I think it is easy to assume in good times that leadership isn't necessary. And then the bad times come. I think it also is easy to get confused. And if someone who's supposed to lead doesn't, but others step up and do, for example, we have governors in this crisis who are stepping up and leading. I think people can get confused about where the leadership came from. But I actually do not believe that an effective leader, regardless of circumstances, is someone who lacks empathy, who lacks humility, who lacks courage and character, and who runs to the spotlight and avoids blame instead of running to the problem. You know, you mentioned Lincoln in the opening. Lincoln was a leader. Lincoln was a leader, clearly. It doesn't mean he was a perfect man, not at all. All leaders are flawed. All leaders make mistakes. We're human beings after all, but he led.
I'm actually looking at now the picture from Fox News from the Lincoln Memorial, and there is the famous statue of Abraham Lincoln towering over Donald Trump, who's sitting there talking with some of the Fox News hosts. And as you know, there was this exchange when he's asked about, you know, why he dealt with the media in the way that he does. This is what President Trump had to say.
Look, I am greeted with a hostile press, the likes of which no president has ever seen. The closest would be that gentleman right up there. They always said Lincoln. Nobody got treated worse than Lincoln. I believe I am treated worse. You're there. You see those press conferences. They come at me with questions that are disgraceful, to be honest, disgraceful.
Carly Fiorina, Donald Trump treated worse than Lincoln?
Oh, it's worse than that, Charlie, honestly. Did President Trump miss the press corps for every preceding president? Would George W. Bush think that he was treated well by the press? Would Barack Obama think he was treated well by Fox News? Every president has a hostile press corps. And by the way, criticism is the price of leadership. It comes with the territory. So someone who gets to be president of the United States, if he honestly expects any president, not just Trump, if any president gets to the Oval Office and thinks that the press corps is going to treat them fairly or kindly, they never should have run for president. A leader needs to understand this. If you can't take the heat of criticism, get out of the kitchen, because criticism is the price. And one of the reasons that Lincoln was a great leader is he had courage to withstand criticism. When I work with leaders in all kinds of settings around this country, it's what I start with. I said, look, don't expect people to give you kudos for making the tough calls and leading when leading is necessary. Instead, you will be criticized. Understand it, learn how to deal with it, but keep leading. Criticism is the price of leadership. Why, Donald Trump, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen.
Yeah, and a pro tip would be that you avoid comparing yourself to Lincoln, to Abraham Lincoln, just in general.
Yes,
right?
I
am greater than Lincoln, or I had it tougher than Abraham Lincoln. But you know, this is Donald Trump. So the Trump defenders would say, well, what he's trying to do now is he's trying to be cheerful. I'm obviously moving on to the next one. This is the greatest comeback ever. It's going to be wonderful. We're going to reopen America. America is the comeback kid. And what they're going to point to will be his optimism, his buoyancy, his ebullience that somehow will give courage and hope to Americans who've been struggling through this economic crisis and to the pandemic. But also, it's a reflection of the fact that Donald Trump does think of this as essentially a PR problem, doesn't he? I mean, this is it's a matter of marketing and framing rather than getting the details necessarily correct.
I think that's true. And I think it's also true that leaders do need to be optimistic in the sense that they need to see possibilities, even in very difficult times. They need to have faith that people can rise to the occasion. But I also always say that optimism must be balanced by clear-eyed realism. Clear-eyed realism. In order to solve any problem, you must be optimistic enough to understand the problem can be solved, but you also have to be clear-eyed and realistic enough to understand the problem you're trying to solve. And I don't believe that Donald Trump has ever accepted the problem he's actually supposed to be solving. So he can open up the country all he wants, but this will be a long, slow slog of a recovery. There is no doubt about that. A V-shaped recovery is not in the cards.
So tell me about you and Donald Trump, your, shall we say, the evolution of your thinking. I think everybody is going to remember one of the most memorable moments of 2016 was when you said that every woman knew what he was saying when he was, you know, commenting in Rolling Stone. But, you know, so you're remembered as being a very sharp critic of candidate Donald Trump. Was there a period where you were more optimistic, where you were willing to cut him some slack, where you were hoping that he was going to change or grow into the office? Give me some sense of how your thinking has evolved from that moment.
Well, yes, my thinking certainly has. Let me say, I voted for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. You will recall when I was running with Ted Cruz that I was very open about why. That I thought Ted Cruz was the only Republican who had a shot of beating Donald Trump, that I thought Donald Trump as the nominee of the Republican Party would be devastating for the Republican Party over time, maybe not right away, but over time. I was very clear in saying that I thought Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were two sides of the same coin. I remember saying that to you, Charlie, that she sold access and he bought access. But nevertheless, when it came down to a choice between two people, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, I thought, okay, I don't agree with Hillary Clinton on much of anything. I do think she is corrupt. I think she's been around for too long. Let's give the new guy a chance. And I wanted him to succeed. And I did give him a chance. And for almost 3 years, Charlie, I did very few media interviews. Mm-hmm. Very few. Because I did not want to criticize him. But there were also certain things about which I could not condone his behavior. I have agreed with some of his policy choices. I have disagreed with many. So like every American, I think we want our president to succeed. And yes, I gave him the opportunity. But honestly, I think in 2020, given what we are facing, given the requirement for leadership, I think, as I said, objectively speaking, no one can say that he is leading. He has his base of supporters who politically want him to win over someone else, but this is not leadership. And a president, first and foremost, is the leader of the country, or should be.
I'm looking at the statement that you posted on Facebook. I think it was late last year, where you talked about the, you know, questioning why so many Republicans had pledged their loyalty to Donald Trump, and that you had been criticized for being disloyal. Was there a breaking point for you? Was there a moment when you said, "Okay, I've given this guy the benefit of the doubt. I'm done with that"?
Well, if you're asking if there was one particular moment, not that I recall, it was an accumulation of things. It was just an accumulation of things. It started, frankly, with, you know, one of the things I believe about character. Character is how you do things, and how you do things is as important as what you do. And so, for example, I had increasing misgivings about, I'm all for legal immigration and making sure that the immigration rules and laws in our country are clear and followed, but the mean-spirited nature of the dialogue has made me very uncomfortable. We are not a small, mean nation. And we have depended, as we do right now during this pandemic, by the way, mm-hmm. we depend on the energy and the hard work of immigrants, and we always have. And so that tone, in addition to some of the policy choices, really distressed me and disturbed me. But it's clear that Republicans who had a point of view about policy, too many Republicans have abandoned our principles because Trump demands loyalty. And I think that is, unfortunately, it will be to the detriment of the Republican Party, not just for the short term, but I fear for the longer term.
So in this piece you wrote, when did so many Republicans decide that we should also pledge allegiance to the party and swear fidelity to President Trump? I have been called disloyal because I am critical of Trump. I am not alone. Many others have been intimidated into silence or compelled to defend the indefensible. And that seems like the story of the Republican Party over the last 3 years. So why do you think this has happened? Because, you know, I think you and I both remember that you could be a Republican and you could criticize Ronald Reagan. You could criticize the first judge, George Bush. You could criticize the second George Bush. It was never a matter of being excommunicated if you questioned the dear leader. What's happened, and why have so many Republicans gone that way? Why have they decided that they had to pledge fidelity to the person of Donald Trump?
Because it's about winning, Charlie. Politics is about winning.
But hasn't it always been about winning?
Yes, but what's different now is the energy of Donald Trump's base and the fear that too many politicians have to cross that base. And so they conclude, I will lose if I cross Donald Trump. You know, George Washington, we're talking about Lincoln, George Washington said a long time ago, the trouble with politicians is they'll come to care only about winning, or words to that effect. And, you know, problem solving is about doing what is necessary to solve a problem. Politics has become all about winning. Just about winning. And so you have too many congressmen and senators who worry about losing their seat as opposed to standing on principle. That's a shame.
So why did you issue this? Weren't you worried that you would also then get caught in the crossfire?
For me, and this is, I hope, always been true of me, I've lost jobs on principle before. There are more important things than hanging on to a job. And one of the more important things than hanging on to a job is hanging on to your soul. Honestly, I've said that for years and years and years. If you sell your soul, no one will ever pay you back. A job won't, press won't, fame won't. And when one abandons one's principles and says things that one doesn't believe, one has sold one's soul. And I'm not willing to sell my soul for anyone.
Did you think at all of running in the primary against Donald Trump?
You mean in 2020?
Yes.
No. Because, and I'll tell you why, because no one can win in the Republican primary against Donald Trump. That's clear. The Republican Party has made sure that's clear. A third party can't win in this country in a general election for president. And so I did not consider it. No. I'm a principled person, but I don't tilt at windmills. I hope to be. I'm a principled person. I try to be. I don't tilt at windmills. That's why I got out of the 2016 primary when I did. If something is impossible, then it's not worth the energy to me.
I bring that up because I had engaged in some baseless, optimistic speculation in the Bulwark when this came out, saying, is Carly Fiorina running? Probably not, but very interesting. But that was wish casting on my part, and I concede this. You said earlier this year you were very, very pointed in saying that you thought it was vital that President Trump be impeached. Talk to me about that.
I think that with leadership comes accountability and responsibility. The president, the position of president, is the most powerful position of leadership in the world. And therefore, we must hold a president, any president, to a higher standard than others. That comes with the territory. Mm-hmm. The responsibility to be held to the highest standards possible comes with the responsibility of being president. And so the behavior that he exhibited with regard to Ukraine is not acceptable by any president. And therefore, it's not acceptable by him either. And therefore, he needed to be impeached, held accountable. Now, whether I also said at the time to vote to remove him for office, okay, I could see, I don't agree with it, but I could see an argument someone could make that say it's an election year. But the act of holding him accountable by impeaching him to demonstrate that this is not acceptable behavior by a president of the United States, that I believed was vital.
So the headline in the New York Times story about this was Carly Fiorina says Trump should be impeached, then in parentheses, but she may vote for him anyway. Well, are you going to vote for him anyway? Have you changed your mind from 2020?
I cannot vote for Donald Trump in 2020.
You will not vote for Donald Trump?
I will not.
Have you decided who you're going to vote for?
Well, you know, it's a two-man race in this country right now. Biden appears to be the likely nominee. We'll see. But depending on how he conducts himself for the first time in my life, it's possible I will not vote, but I will not vote for President Trump.
Speaking of Joe Biden, actually, I want to sort of dial back because your confrontation with Donald Trump in 2016 really had a lot to do with his attitude towards women. And two things struck me today before we started this podcast. I was going over his interview on Fox News at the Lincoln Memorial, and none of his treatment of women, none of the allegations against him were even raised. There have been, what, two dozen women who have accused him of various forms of misconduct. And then I turn on MSNBC, and they're still on Joe Biden and the allegations against him. So I just want to get your sense of how these issues are going to play out, how Joe Biden has handled it, how the media should handle the allegations against Donald Trump.
So first, I have to say that I think people, we come to know people, whoever they are, over their lifetime, not just over 3 weeks of a campaign or 3 months of a campaign. And so if you look at Donald Trump's behavior over a lifetime, the way he has publicly spoken about women for a lifetime, I find the allegations against him believable. Why? Because he's used incredibly disrespectful language about women for decades. Because he's commented about women in a certain way for decades. Now we turn to Joe Biden. Joe Biden has been in the public eye for decades. To the best of my knowledge, there have not been accusations that have come forward before now. He speaks in a certain way. He does not speak in a disrespectful way to women, about women or to women. So I believe that women should be heard, but I don't believe every woman is believable, just as I don't believe that every man is believable. And so I read Joe Biden's statement with interest. I find that statement compelling, I must say. I find this woman not necessarily credible. It's hard for me to understand how you go from "he put his hands on my shoulder and that made me uncomfortable" to several months later, "no, actually, he assaulted me." Doesn't seem all that credible to me. But, you know, it's May and the election's in November, and I'm out of the business of predicting the future, other than to say that President Trump got my vote once. He will not get it again.
If Joe Biden were to call you up today and say, "I am committed to naming a woman for my vice presidential running mate," what kind of advice would you give him? What do you think he should do?
Well, I think Joe Biden doesn't need to call me for advice, nor will he. He's publicly said he's going to pick a woman.
I have decided I'm going to pick a woman. How should I go about making that decision? And going back, let's go back to this context of leadership, because it's very possible that whoever he chooses will be the first woman president of the United States. So this strikes me as a very different, this is a non-routine vice presidential pick.
Well, let's go back to the basics. The individual, man or woman, but in this case, woman, needs to be qualified. My goodness, how many male vice presidents have we had that weren't qualified? So I only say that to say that always when it's a woman, no matter what it is, always when it's a woman, suddenly we get very concerned about things that, politically speaking, we haven't always been concerned about with men. I made the case and was criticized for doing so that Donald Trump wasn't qualified to be president. He wasn't. I think he's demonstrated that he isn't now. But yes, I think a woman should be qualified to be president. If not, no other reason than Joe Biden is in his late 70s. And so I know there will be a lot of discussion about, you know, politically who and which states and all the rest of it. But let's just start with the basics, that someone needs to be qualified, which means they have to have had an experience set that qualifies them. You know, the reality is this, Charlie, whether it's men or women, we've sort of gotten to the place where there are certain constitutional requirements to be president or to run for president, but those aren't necessarily the same things as qualifications to actually execute the responsibilities of a president in these highly complex times. And so just as I think tough times remind us that leadership is important, I hope as citizens that these tough times will remind us to raise our standards for what we expect of politicians, that we actually want them to be problem solvers and leaders, and that we actually would like them to be qualified for the jobs that they're running for.
You know, I sort of slid over a point that we were getting at very early in the podcast when we were talking about leadership in a time of crisis. And you mentioned the number of governors who had really stepped up. And, you know, in terms of the Republican Party caving into Donald Trump, I think a lot of people are focusing on members of Congress. But to the extent that there's a Trump skeptical Republican Party, it's doing quite well in the governorships. And this is kind of their moment. That you are seeing this sort of executive leadership. It wasn't that long ago that there was kind of a conventional wisdom that when you were looking for a future president, that governors had a leg up because they had actually run something at one point. And I think we've kind of gotten away from that.
Yeah, I do think experience running things matters, because the executive branch of the federal government is a gigantic bureaucracy. It always has been. The deep state didn't arrive with Donald Trump. It's always been a gigantic bureaucracy. Competent government matters. We can argue about whether it should be big government or small government. And you and I, Charlie, believe small, limited government is better. We believe there should be more decision-making in the hands of governors, not more in the hands of a president of the United States. But maybe these times will remind us that competent government matters. And that when you concentrate power, and money, ultimately, the power is going to get abused, the money is going to get wasted. And if you have someone in that position who isn't qualified, boy, are the consequences dire.
You know, a question I've really been wanting to ask you is one that in the back of my mind, when I'm thinking of Donald Trump and his leadership and his qualifications, and of course, a lot of his supporters thought, well, it's time to put a businessman in the White House because, you know, he knows how to run a business. Well, really, is there any publicly traded company in the United States that would consider hiring Donald Trump to be their CEO?
No. No. And by the way, I can remember saying this during the 2016 election. Somebody said to me, an interviewer on CNBC actually said to me, well, you know, you're a business person. He's a business person. Do you think the critique of his business career is unfair? And I said, as a business person, I find the critique very fair. Running a family-owned business where you are the autocrat on top is very different than running, to the point of your question, a publicly traded company or even a small business where you have a level of accountability that Donald Trump didn't have. Going bankrupt 4 times, getting sued over and over and over again for things like Trump University, that's not a stellar business career. So I think business people can be problem solvers and leaders in politics and elsewhere, but please don't hold Donald Trump up as a business person. Someone asked me in the 2016, what one word would I use to describe Donald Trump? And my answer was an entertainer. And I think he is a superb entertainer. And now it turns out that he's a pretty good politician, too.
Well, we'll see whether he's able to pull that off. But we are at the strange moment in American culture where I think that we have higher standards for the people. I mean, if a car dealer worked, you know, operated the way that Donald Trump did, we would not tolerate it. You know, if in almost any other walk of life, some of Donald Trump's behavior would be disqualifying. So we're at the point now where our expectations and the qualifications we expect from a president of the United States are lower than virtually any other position of responsibility. The military would not tolerate it. There's no hospital that would tolerate a staff member behaving this way. As you point out, publicly traded companies would not tolerate it. So this is the question, is whether or not he's permanently lowered our expectations for the office or whether we can restore it. And I have to admit that I'm not terribly optimistic about our ability to restore the norms and the expectations that have been shattered. What about you?
Well, I hope you're wrong, but I agree. I share your concern. I really do. And however, I do think that if you look at polls, one of the things that comes through is people tend to respond to, we were talking about Biden, they tend to respond to a perception that he is empathetic and competent and decent, whether they agree with him or not. And so I do think, I think people are afraid of Donald Trump and the political consequences that he can exact for politicians. I think there are people who truly are his base of supporters. And I have friends who are in that group who honestly believe he's doing a great job. I don't understand their point of view, but okay. But I think most people, given enough time and enough information, figure things out. So, of course, they need enough time and they need enough information. And it's why Donald Trump is so focused on controlling the narrative. But with enough time and enough information, I think most people would prefer decent, competent leadership over the opposite.
That seems to be what's on offer in 2020. We'll find out whether that in fact is true. So, what's next for you? Are you at all thinking about running for public office in the future? Are you open to that possibility? Have you closed the door to that possibility?
Well, I haven't closed the door, and I'm always open to all possibilities. Honestly, Charlie, I mean, people don't believe me, but it's true. I never planned to become a CEO. I didn't plan to run for president. I focus my time on things that I think make a positive difference. I have always been engaged in developing leaders because I think we need more of them, whatever their position is. And I think we need more problem solvers. And when opportunities come along, I think I understand how to assess them. So I'm not in the business of predicting the future, nor am I in the business of closing off possibilities.
Okay, so that sounds like a really wide open door.
Yeah, I think so. Okay.
So what would you be interested in? Would you be interested in...
And I don't answer hypotheticals, Charlie. I learned that in politics.
Okay. So I won't even go that way. But that is interesting. So what else should we... You know, there's so much going on. Part of the problem is that, you know, on a Monday morning, I sit here and I think about all the things that have happened since Friday that we've already forgotten about. And I know I use the term Earth 2.0 too often, but there are so many stories that would normally have absorbed the news cycles that we lose sight of. I think one of the most alarming things going on in Washington right now with the administration is that Donald Trump has decided that he is going to eliminate the watchdogs, the inspector generals, all of the people who would dissent from his happy talk. And in a lot of ways, this is, you know, to create, as you point out, he needs to create, you know, he needs to control the narrative. But it does feel like this Soviet Chernobyl era, we are not going to give you bad news. Don't you dare tell people anything that casts the leader in a bad light. So the lack of transparency in the federal government seems to be now, that could be a real danger going forward.
Yes. And this is where the column, the Facebook post that you referenced earlier comes in. This is where we should demand that our elected officials in Congress and the House and the Senate do their job. When Republicans will not stand up and say the obvious, watchdogs, some of them do. I mean, Lamar Alexander stands up and talks about the importance of whistleblowers and watchdogs, and Mitt Romney has said some things. But honestly, this is not a political question. This is a governance question. We must have watchdogs. We must have whistleblower statutes that work. This is incredibly important. And it used to be that it was the Republican Party that railed against the concentration of power in the executive branch. Where is that party now?
Well, we've been asking that for some time. And unfortunately, I think that party right now is joined at the hip with Donald Trump, for better or for worse. I assume you've read some of the accounts that Republicans are getting increasingly nervous about November, and they're trying to figure out ways to socially distance themselves from Donald Trump. I'm thinking it's too late for that.
Well, you know, there need to be consequences for people's behavior. Accountability matters. If Americans don't believe that there is consequence for decisions made, then we've lost everything. And so I'm sure people are starting to worry and asking themselves, how can I distance myself from Donald Trump? And that might get really ugly looking before this is over. There are many things that Republicans could do besides distance themselves to put some checks and balances back into government right now. So I'd like to hold them accountable for doing that. And starting with standing up against firing watchdogs and decimating the whistleblower statutes, that'd be a good place to start.
Yeah, this would be a moment in a crisis to assert their own prerogatives as well. I think one of the among the disturbing elements has been the way that Congress has sort of erased itself from a leadership role. You would think that there would be some people would say, here is an opportunity to step up and lead, as opposed to in many ways kind of reassert their potted plant status.
Yes, exactly right. And so let's go back to problem solving just for a moment. So the federal government, I think we have gotten this response completely backwards. And I think House and Senate members could have helped get it right to the point of your comment. What does the federal government have that no one else in the world has in addition to the ability to print money? The federal government has more purchasing power than any other entity on the planet, and more distribution power as well. What do governors have? Governors have closeness to the problem. They're closer to the ground. So what I believe should have happened if we were focused on problem solving and Congress could have had something to do with this, the federal government should have taken over the procurement of all the necessary equipment and distributed it. And the governors should have been block granted money to save small businesses, to help working families, to invest in hospitals if necessary. What happens when all the money flows through the federal government? Guess what? The big are always advantaged over the small. I talked about this during the 2016 primary, right? When you have all this money flowing through the federal government, the big business gets it before the little business. The wealthy guys gets tax breaks. Working families get nothing. Push the money out to 50 states, hold governors accountable for distributing that money, and ask the federal government to do what only it can do, procure everything that's necessary at the cheapest price possible and distribute it.
That almost makes too much sense.
Well, sadly, because, of course, that's because it's a problem-solving approach.
Right, whereas Donald Trump wanted to have his name on the checks. His point was,
exactly.
I want the credit for this, whether it actually solves the problem or not.
Yes, and senators and congressmen probably wanted the credit as well. But the problem, of course, now is that the money isn't going where it's intended. I mean, some of it is going to where it should go. But, you know, really bailing out United Airlines while small businesses are getting crushed, that was the wrong set of priorities. And you would have expected the Republican Party to stand up and say, no, let's block grant this money to the governors. Let's focus on the small, really small, not these big companies that have the Federal Reserve standing behind them and all the big banks standing behind them. But not a peep, not a peep.
I worry about it. I want to see whether you share this. I worry about a major progressive populist backlash to this because, you know, when you have Bernie Sanders saying that the system is rigged and then you read that, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars went to these large corporations while mom and pop businesses were drowning and people couldn't meet their rent payments, there's a plausibility to that. I mean, when you have something this big happening, it could change our politics. And I'm concerned that the way they've mishandled it could lead to a very dramatic shift to the left in our politics.
Yes, I agree. And so let's come back to first principles. Power concentrated is power abused, period. That it's a principle upon which our nation was founded. Power concentrated is power abused. That's true in business, which is why I'm concerned about Amazon and Google and Facebook, but it is surely true in government. And so, yes, I worry that we are not taking care of working families. I worry that we don't have a healthcare system that works for everybody. I worry that small businesses are getting crushed, but a huge government bureaucracy will not fix that. Because the more money and power you concentrate in Washington, the more true it is that the big survive and the small get crushed and the wealthy do better and the powerless lose money and power. So the progressive, more big government programs, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, it won't work. It'll just make it worse. This is why we need a voice that says limited government works for a reason. We ought to distribute money and power out to the states so that we're not concentrating everything in Washington, D.C. And the voices that used to say that in the Republican Party, the people who have been elected as Republicans, sadly, haven't spent any time saying that. And so perhaps, unfortunately, sadly, they're going to have to learn the consequences of abandoning their principles at the ballot box.
Carly Fiorina, thank you so much for joining me today on the Bulwark Podcast and being so generous with your time.
Well, thank you, Charlie. It's always great to talk with you. And thank you for your voice. It matters.
And thank you all for listening to today's podcast. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.